Session number 5190, Lieutenant Colonel Cyril Luckin, Reel 1.
Could you tell me something about your family background?
Well, purely military. That my father was a mechanist, quartermaster sergeant in Royal Engineers, and I am one of a family of four, the only boy, born in Aldershot. Later, somewhere around about 1901, we moved down to Shoeburyness, where my father was the mechanist in charge of all the mechanical work of the Royal Engineers down there. Shoeburyness in those days was the school of gunnery and also the main proving and testing ground for all the big guns, naval as well as army, running anything from the 6 inches up to 15 inch, testing armour plate, etc. and so forth. And situated as it is, right on the peninsula, jutting out into the Thames opposite the Nore lightship, you had a wonderful view there of the London River when the shipping was probably at its densest, and the Port of London was really at its height. The tides, of course, ran out roughly about a mile to a mile and a half in a direct line, or if you moved out over the mapping sands, you could go out as far as 25 miles. But one had to be fairly wary because some of the tides and the swings could be extremely... But that is my general background. Personally, I went to the garrison school, so-called. We didn't have a school as such. We had army schoolmasters. But we used to occupy empty barrack rooms during the winter season. In the springtime, when they started the artillery courses and the rooms were needed, we then moved down into an old volunteer hut about a mile away, where we were allowed to remain until, this was before the TA was formed, when the volunteers would start coming down for roughly their Easter camps, and we then had to move, and we finished up in marquees spread round the edge of the parade ground. But for all those handicaps, I think we got, on the whole, an extremely good basic education.
What age did that education...
Well, that took you up to 14. Mm. In my own particular case, it was one of these very lucky coincidences, in that my father finished his 21 years service and had to come out, coinciding with my more or less 14th birthday, so that I left school on the Friday of my 14th birthday and started work on the following Monday as not really an apprentice, because the War Department don't take apprentices, but as a carpenter's boy in the Royal Engineer Workshops. The rate of pay was exactly 1 penny an hour. We worked a 51-hour week. I can remember this extremely well because I was paid with 2 coins, a 4-shilling piece, which was still currency in those days, and a threepenny bit. And having only 2 coins made it very easy for distribution between the interested parties, as my mother took the 4 bob and I got the threepence. And I continued down there until roughly I was 17. Then I left and went up to Harford. My father, before that, had obtained the post of instructor of handicraft to Haileybury College. And so I moved up there and I worked for about approximately 12 months. With a firm of builders and contractors in Harvard. whose main speciality was the restoration of churches and work on old country residences. So it was extremely interesting work.
So when did you join the army?
Well, that's just about it then.
Yeah. That was, what
then,
year was that?
In 1912, the end of 1912. For some reason, I couldn't explain now, I had the idea that I would like to emigrate to, I won't say South Africa, but rather Southern Africa. I think I was a little bit struck by Rider Haggard's works of King Solomon's Mines, Nard of the Lily and various and that. And I had the idea, knowing the military ropes, of how this could be done at no expense to myself. And obviously I couldn't afford the fare. And in those days, if one enlisted, in the Royal Engineers anyway, you had to enlist for 6 years with the colours and 6 on the reserve. Now, it took approximately 9 months or so, 9 to 10 months to complete your basic training, after which, of course, you would be posted away to a unit. Well, knowing the ropes, I thought, well, now, if I join the Royal Engineers, which I can do because I am a tradesman, as a carpenter, otherwise they wouldn't take you. At the end of my training, I'll volunteer to join a Royal Engineer unit in South Africa. The only units out there at that time were 2 field companies, and anybody that volunteered to go to a field company was bound to get his request met, because nobody particularly wanted to go to a field company. It was a bit tough. But South Africa in those days was a 5-year station. So that my figuring was, if I get out to South Africa at the end of my first year, I do 5 years in the country, my 6 years are up, I shall be time expired and tour expired at approximately the same time. I can take my discharge in the country, which was allowed, and I would have emigrated free of charge, and that was that. Well, I joined up in December 1912, and my plans worked very, very well, and I was out in Pretoria, where I joined the 55th Field Company, I think just at the end of November 1913. And as I thought, things were going very nicely until somebody decided to start a war in August 1914, which blew the whole scheme sky high, because with the exception of, I think, about 1 fortress unit, all of the South African garrison were withdrawn, and we came home on a fairly large convoy with 6 liners, etc., and so forth, back to this country, en route for active service. That was the end of my South African adventures.
And throughout that time, what rank did you hold?
Oh, the only rank I held, I was merely a sapper. Hmm. I couldn't get any lower, put it that way.
And so when you finished in South Africa, what country did you go to next?
On active service. Hmm. We came back here. We landed in Southampton approximately, I should think, in the middle of September 1914. We then formed part of the 7th Division, which was being assembled and built up here at Lyndhurst in the New Forest. The bulk of the division was made up of battalions which had come from overseas stations from all over the place. 2 battalions of guards, etc., and so forth. And we eventually left Southampton on the 7th of October 1914 and landed on the mole, which afterwards became quite famous in history, the mole at Zeebrugge on the 9th of October 1914. Then after running around the country for a good many miles, quite a number of days, not knowing quite what we were doing, but anyway, we were doing it. And we eventually finished up in Ypres and went into action for the first time under fire on the 18th of October 1914. And that, of course, was served through the First Battle of Ypres. And from then onwards, it was just a matter of active service of various things. I was actually present naturally right through the First Battle of Ypres. Our next major engagement was at Neuve Chapelle in March 1915. In April 15, my unit was rushed up to the Ypres salient again to help restore the defences after the breakthrough of the Canadian front after the following the first gas attack. We were only up there, I think, for about 3 weeks. We then came back and rejoined our own division. We took part in the Battle of Festubert and again in Givenchy. And about August 1915, the very first Guards Division was formed. And the two Guards battalions that had been in the 20th Brigade went down to form part of this new division, and we, as a field company, went with them. So that we left the 7th Division altogether and joined in with the Guards Division, whose very first engagement was at the Battle of Loos. And from then on, we had a fairly sticky time from then on until about mid-October, and I got fairly severely wounded during a sortie in the rather famous or infamous Hohenzollern Redoubt, trying to blow up an enemy machine gun emplacement, and the occupants didn't see eye to eye with us, and so that was the end of my active service.
So what happened? You were injured. How were you injured?
I was hit on the water bottle. A rifle grenade, actually, and I still have the nose cap and a piece of the water bottle is still in there. It also cut through my arm there, partly paralysed, and two small pieces into the right lung, but very small bits anyway.
You were saved by the water bottle, were you?
Saved by being too close to it. I don't know, of course. It probably did more damage to those three or four people who were fairly close to me than it did to me, because it was too close to me, the pieces would fly out. You know.
So you then were taken back to England, were you, to hospital?
After a while, as I have quite good recollections of being hauled down the trench in a waterproof sheet and travelling on a wheel stretcher. I can remember arriving in a field dressing station, and I remember the doctor saying something about an anti-tetanus injection, and beyond that I know nothing further until it must have been some 3 or 4 days later that I found myself in a hospital in Boulogne. Where I'd been to in the meantime I wouldn't know. It must have been by ambulance and hospital train, etc., and so forth. And I remained in Boulogne Hospital until probably the end of November 1915, and sent home on a hospital ship and finished up in the Cornelia Hospital down here in Poole. And I was there and in convalescent home at Wimborne until May 1915. And then I'd been classified as medical category C, but I was sent from Wimborne to Cosham, just outside of Portsmouth, which was supposed to be the place where you were given your final medical inspection and categorised. And to be quite frank, the conditions there were so appalling that I just simply told them I was A1, and they accepted it, and that was that. And I eventually finished up back in my depot somewhere about June 1915.
Where was your depot?
Chatham.
Chatham. So what happened then?
Well, I remained at Chatham and Maidstone for what was left of 1916 and 17, mainly on general duties, and in the meantime I had been promoted Lance Corporal, and also a rank which has long since been abolished, and which was peculiar to the Royal Engineers as a second corporal. And I got married in 1917. And then early in 1918, they decided to restart the Foreman of Works classes in Chatham. To explain that was that in those days, and of course right up until somewhere in the 1950s of this year, all the Royal Engineers were responsible for all the Army's requirements as regards buildings, fortifications, every mortal thing that the Army required in the way of housing, quarters, fortifications, roads, water, was done by us, both at home and abroad. And that was mainly staffed by what they call the Staff of Royal Engineer Services. And my own particular line, that they used to run what they called Foreman of Works classes at the School of Military Engineering, which is now the Royal School of Military Engineering. It took approximately 12 months, and you went through the fact, of course, you had to be a tradesman before you were accepted. You had to have a first-class school certificate. You had to be a non-commissioned officer, obviously, of good character, and so forth. And you went through various examinations at each stage. You had examinations in draftsmanship and architectural work, electrical work, road surveying, plane surveying, etc., and so forth, quantity surveying, measurements of every sort, size and description. And then when you took your final examination, you were then took your seniority according to your position in the examination roster, and you were then posted off to some station or the other where you did 6 months probation. Now, if at the end of the 6 months probation you were favourably reported on by the Commander Royal Engineer of the district where you had been, you got substantive promotion to Staff Sergeant, Foreman of Works.
You went to Winchester, didn't you?
In my case, I went to Winchester. I did my 6 months there. At the end of that 6 months, I just got orders out of the blue, pack and go to Palestine.
So you, yes. So Palestine was your next port of call. How long did you spend in Palestine?
In Palestine itself, about 2 years and 3 months, I think, altogether. But it was a combined station with Egypt, because the Mediterranean in those days was also a five-year station. But in view of the very rough conditions in Palestine immediately after the First World War, I only did 2 years in Palestine and the following three in Egypt. Or it could go the other way. You could do 3 years in Egypt and do 2 years in Palestine. In actual fact, I went to Palestine and did my 2 years and some 3 months up there, and then in April 1922, that's right, I came down to a place called Sidi Bish, which is actually Alexandria, just about 10 miles outside the city of Alexandria.
So what did your what was your rank when you were stationed in Palestine?
As a staff sergeant.
Staff sergeant. Yeah. And what sort of things were you doing there?
Well, very difficult because multifarious duties, because when I went, the Commander Royal Engineers in those days, the whole thing was just being built up from the end of the war, I'd say that. There was sort of nothing there at all, a bit of a hiatus from the end of the war. There were very few British troops up there. When I first went up, I think there was one British battalion, some of that light infantry at Acre. There may have been one where the Prince of Wales Volunteers were down in South Palestine. But in the main, we had Indian troops up there, Punjabi Regiment, the Central Indian Horse, the Bengal Lancers. There was one company of sappers and miners, etc., and so forth. And very difficult to say, you might say, put very clearly just what I'd got to do. But because in that, we started from scratch. I first went up to the railhead at Samak, which is right on the south end of the Sea of Galilee. And one of the first things I had to do there was to try and get some accommodation for myself, which I succeeded in borrowing a tent of one of the Indian units. Otherwise, I was stuck. One of the first jobs was to do some sort of a survey of the Samak encampment itself. There was only one two-story building there, which was the railway station. There was probably about a dozen huts built of mud with a very small civilian Palestinian occupation. The remainder of the railway ran right through there, then way through the Daraa Gorge up to Damascus, which of course was outside of our, because they ran into the French territory there. So that we had not got any form of survey or map of this camp at all. So that I was told to produce one, and the only thing that I had to produce it was an ordinary prismatic compass and 100-foot tape. So that it was quite a fearsome job, because the only way that I could possibly do it was use a certain number of stakes and put one here and put one there, take a compass bearing on it, then tape it out, and then offshoot, right or left, anything up to 200 or 300 yards if I could guess a right angle fairly well, and get over it that way. But it tied it together fairly well when I'd finished it. I also got landed with the job of offloading about a 60-foot motorboat, which they'd sent up from Egypt to put into the Sea of Galilee, and about 4 old whaler naval cutters. The cutters didn't present any great difficulty, because we could push those off the end of a rather rickety old pier that had been built probably by the Turkish army, and they were there. But the motorboat presented some difficulties, because we hadn't a crane, we had no lifting. The only way that I could do it was to build crib, plenty of sleepers available because it was a railhead, was to build crib pier alongside the truck, and with the help of the Indian troops, we gradually moved this thing off onto the crib pier and then lowered it down onto the ground and got it onto rollers. The next thing that I was faced with was we'd got about an 8-foot cliff to get it down, mainly clay. So they got the Central Indian Horse, much to their commanding officer's horror, but he could see the funny part of it, to use their lances and drill holes in the clay and I had discovered a whole lot of old Turkish explosive. Seemed to me to be a type of aminol. I tried it out and it seemed to be quite effective, so just stuffed this along in these holes with sandbags and old rags, etc., and so forth, and blew the whole thing up, and it worked quite well, so that instead of having to probably shovel for the best part of a week, we managed in about 24 hours to clear a slide, and we got the motorboat down into the lake, which of course was very, very useful, because a ration dump existed at the other end of the lake, at a place called Tabgha, which was the scene of the, what do they call it, the Sermon on the Mount, that's right, of the two loaves and the five small fishes. Well, it was then possible to take rations and things across the lake, more one end of the lake to the other, rather than take them on camelback right round on the side and up through Tiberias and round the other way.
Was it at Samak that you met the Russian refugees? I think you told
me. Oh, no.
That was later.
Well, I had those when I got them up and around Rosh Pina.
Yes,
well, then I also had to get round and arrange a number of contracts, which you did by means of Dutch auction, that to build a number of mud brick huts, three or four at Samak, about a half a dozen more at Tabgha, for this right now. There, of course, there were no materials available to the civil market, so we used to have to provide all the necessary timber and corrugated iron and things of that nature. One left it to the local contractors to produce the mud bricks. They knew better how to do it, make them than I did. And I used to have a Dutch auction by going round to Tiberias and one or two other little villages. And I had quite a good interpreter there in Arabic, etc. and so forth. And we just asked somebody to give us a quote how much they'd do it for. And one conducted the auction the other way round, so they gradually got lower and lower until thought you'd got down to the bedrock, and you then agreed that was the contract, and he'd do the hut for so and so, and you would provide this, they would provide that, so and so.